Well, welcome to another episode of the Leadership Enigma podcast. And, well, it just gets better and better, doesn't it? Because we are now doing episodes and interviews all over the world in the most wonderful of locations. And this is perhaps the smallest location that I've done an episode, but perhaps the most wonderful. Because, as you'll be aware, this is indeed a private jet. Something I've never been on before, so that's a first. But there is a story as to why this episode is on a private jet. Trust me, you do not want to miss this particular episode when I'm going to be talking to the wonderful Edwin Brennigmeyer to find out why we sat on a private jet, Edwin, and how did this all happen? So come back to me just after the break for this amazing episode. Hi, I'm Adam Pacifico, and welcome to the Leadership Enigma, a world-ranked, award-winning podcast that's insatiably curious as regards what leaders do, how they do it, and importantly, why. We'll delve into the human doing, but even deeper into the human being and the power of human-centered leadership to drive sustainable change. So whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, corporate executive, each week we speak to global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts and disruptors, as together we will discover that success leaves clues. Edwin, it's a huge warm welcome to the Leadership Enigma. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Adam. Thank you so much for having me. It's a real honour.
Well, I think I should be saying that to you because we're on one of your jets. But there's a story to that. Just help everyone understand, where are we? Because you'll do a much better job than me.
Sure. So this is a Pilatus PC-24 jet. And I think to answer your question, why are we on this jet? I think there's a lot of misconception about what business aviation is all about.
Right.
People see jets on Hollywood and they see very, very large aircraft. You know, a lot of the time flying a business jet is a productivity tool.
Yes.
People actually use it for business. They use it to get to meetings more efficiently, to have multiple meetings, so multiple hops in one day, and then be able to get to their families at night without staying in a hotel overnight.
Right.
So it's a very, very different kind of concept from what a lot of people think.
And when we talk about your jet, you're in the aviation business. So mm-hmm. You're currently the CEO of an aviation business. So
correct.
Just help everybody understand that.
Yeah, so I started the company back in 2015. I have always been very, very passionate about aviation. I've benefited personally from aviation. So as a pilot, you know, flying myself around, I used to be in the retail business. So using the aeroplane to actually visit stores where normally people can only go from major airport to major airport and not see some of the ancillary stores,
right,
has been a big, big benefit to me, as well as the sheer enjoyment of flying and the pleasure of flying. And that's what led me to aviation, to starting an aviation business. And yeah, so started in 2015 and we've grown it ever since.
So let me go back to the word pilot, because mm-hmm. I heard that loud and clear. And you were a pilot from a very young age. So
correct.
Just tell everybody when you first fell in love and started your private pilot's license, because you were young.
I think when I first fell in love with aviation was probably when I was about 3 or 4, my right. mother tells me. I mean,
right.
I can't remember that, but
okay.
I've always wanted to fly. I've always just felt we live in a three-dimensional world, but we only operate in two dimensions, so I had to explore the third dimension.
Right.
And I just love aviation, and had model aeroplanes as a child. And then when we went on holiday, we were quite close to a little airfield
yes.
in Switzerland. And I pestered my parents and pestered them relentlessly. And eventually I did a flight. And the pilot who flew me that day let me fly the aeroplane,
right.
let me handle the controls.
Wow.
When we landed, he told my parents that I had some talent. I mean, I was so lucky. So many things came together.
Right.
And I owe a lot to that particular pilot.
Have you ever gone back to that person and said thank you for
I have.
That moment in
I
time?
I have. He lives in Basel in Switzerland. So, yeah, so I'm still in touch with him. But he's most amazing guy, and I'm so grateful to him for doing that. And I think that helped convince my parents to get me into aviation. And I was allowed one flying lesson every holiday, so I learned from 14 to 17, soloed at 17, and
yes.
got my license shortly after. So.
Wow. So you got your private pilot's license at age 17. Just help us understand, what did you have to do in order to get that?
So, as I say, my route was slightly unusual because I started so young. So
yep.
normally you have your first solo at around 15 to 20 hours.
Right.
But I did everything. So I didn't go solo. Did all my tests and all my exams before my 17th birthday.
Right.
And then I did my 10 hours of solo as soon as I got my 17. As soon as I was 17.
So you actually qualified at 17.
So I qualified shortly after my 17th birthday, yes.
Most people will be driving a car at 17.
I must have been the youngest pilot in Britain to have been soloing on my 17th birthday by definition.
Oh, that's amazing, isn't it?
On that particular day. I'm sure it wasn't the first, but yeah.
So I want to go backwards to go forwards, because yes, we sat on this incredible plane. Mm-hmm. Yes, you're the CEO of an aviation company, but that's not how life started, is it? You were born into really a retail focused mm-hmm. family and six generations worth. So
that's
tell
it,
us
exactly.
a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I think again, I was very privileged to have been born into that family, and I learned a lot about leadership. I mean, this is a podcast about leadership, so yep. I learned a lot about people management and about leadership from those retail days.
Right.
You know, retail is all about people and all about managing people. And I think also, you know, we've been a family business, as you said, six generations, which is a long time.
It's a real legacy, isn't it?
It is. Right. Yeah. So, you know, I learned about, you know, long-term value creation, which we can come back to maybe later in the podcast, but, you know, long-term value creation, doing business ethically. And it makes sense. I mean, aviation actually is a very, very small industry, and mm-hmm. everyone knows each other. And unfortunately, not all players in aviation do act ethically, and they generally don't tend to live for as long. You know, right. they don't survive as long because their reputation gets damaged and okay. tarnished. So the importance of doing business ethically was really drummed into me from a very early age.
We're going to come back to that because
sure.
I know we've spoken before. I want to talk about the ethics side of things, the mm-hmm. human-centered leadership piece mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. your role as CEO mm-hmm. of this particular organization. But just help me understand, what was it like where you were really born into a retail focus and mm-hmm. you actually started mm-hmm. within retail, but mm-hmm. then you made a shift? So just mm-hmm. help me understand that decision-making process where you thought, I really, in some ways, cut your claws
yep.
Within retail. You say you learned so much within the family dynamic, but then
right.
thought, no, I want to focus on my own path.
Yeah.
Just help me understand that decision-making process.
So I always had this nagging, burning desire to do something in aviation because that right. was my passion. So I learned a lot about, as I say, about leadership in the family business, and then I was able to transfer that learning across. So the way that happened is because in around about the mid-2000s, there was a lot of technology that was evolving. So there was a confluence of three things that were happening in industry.
Right.
So avionics, power plants, and also the manufacturing technique.
Okay.
And a lot of very, very savvy tech entrepreneurs decided to capitalize on that and produce a very cost-effective jet.
Right.
And that's really where I started to explore that aircraft. So we have, within our family business, we have venture capital as well. So I used that as a platform to explore that industry,
right.
to learn a little bit more about entrepreneurship, a little bit more about aviation.
Yeah.
And that enabled me to make the transition because, frankly, there wasn't a lot of deal flow in that part of the market at the time. You know, a lot of these businesses were, or the business plans rather, were written by pilots who were very well trained as pilots, but perhaps didn't speak the same language as a venture capitalist.
Right.
You know, weren't thinking perhaps so much about the market and the market opportunity. They're thinking more about technology, which was wonderful. But,
right.
but you know, the key for us, of course, is what's the market and what's
okay.
the opportunity.
So what was your biggest learning when you were using the venture capital vehicle to learn, really, and see what was going on? What was kind of your biggest takeaway at that point? Was it the piece about the pilots being great pilots, but perhaps not the right?
I think it was partly that, but I think also, surprisingly perhaps, and I'm sure all the VCs listening to this will understand this, but the majority of the decision-making, if you're looking at a business, is actually, it's not the financials, it's the team. So it goes
right.
back to people again.
Okay.
You know, it's, you know, the VC spent a lot of time looking at the team, looking at the people, and really assessing, you know, are they capable of doing a job?
Okay. Tell me a little bit more about your focus, because you're the CEO running this particular business.
Mm-hmm.
Just, again, help people understand in general terms what the business is doing.
Sure, yeah. So we started off working with a Swiss manufacturer called Pilatus.
Yes.
So we purchase the airplanes from Pilatus. So we
yeah.
take all the risk on the airplanes at a wholesale price,
right.
and then we sell them at a retail price. So the risk is high, but the reward is also very high. So with that reward,
yes.
we reinvest that into producing really exceptional service.
Okay.
So we have the maintenance. We're a true one-stop shop. So we have maintenance. We also have flight operations as well. We can charter a customer's assets out if
yes.
they want to. Let's say they're only flying privately for, let's say, 200 hours a year. So
right.
we can charter it out for, let's say, 300 hours a year
yes.
and actually help them to offset their costs. So it's truly a one-stop shop. So we started with Pilatus. We're now also working with an Italian manufacturer, Tecnam.
Yep.
And we're also expanding our maintenance business. So we're also working with Cirrus now on maintenance as well.
Right. And as we're sat on this plane and people are looking at what they're looking at, we can get eight people on this one. That's correct.
We can, correct.
And
exactly.
Two pilots?
Well, it is approved for one pilot. So it
right.
is a single crew airplane, but we would generally recommend two pilots fly the airplane.
Okay. So potentially 10 people on board.
Correct.
What's the range of this?
So with between 5 and 6 passengers, you can fly 2,000 nautical miles.
Right.
So it's
okay.
ideal for flying certainly within Europe or near Asia or Africa, you know.
Right.
In the US, it's a very different market. But yeah,
right,
certainly
okay.
for Europe, that's our range.
And then obviously they can refuel and then go onward. And
correct.
Is
yeah.
that quite the norm?
That is the norm. So, I mean, another benefit of all that range is you don't necessarily have to. So let's say we're flying to Switzerland. If you're flying privately, fuel is actually taxed in Switzerland. So you don't have to refuel in Switzerland. You can, of course, fly there and fly back. So you can tank a fuel and strategically work out the most cost-effective places to refuel.
And as we sit here rather luxuriously, this does feel like a Swiss engineering or craftsmanship at its best. Let me ask you a little bit something. I know you did an MBA at Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
And what was behind that? Because I recently spoke to actually the global MBA, but at Cambridge.
Oh,
and it was an incredible and eclectic mix of leaders from all over the world. But I was always, and a vast array, but what was behind you doing that?
So Oxford, what I loved about Oxford was there was a focus on entrepreneurship.
Right.
And the Side Business School was very focused on that side of things. So, and also I did a an executive MBA, which I personally thought was fantastic.
Yes.
Because a lot of what you learn at Oxford is, shall we say, theoretical. I mean, yes, there are case studies as well, but you can benefit. Doing an executive MBA, you can really benefit from the learning experience of the other people on the course.
Right.
Because they'd all had a lot of experience. So, for example, I was actually with a finance expert. So I never come from the finance industry. So he's able to help me with that. And he'd never come from entrepreneurship. So with my venture capital experience, I was able to help him with that side of things. So it just worked very, very well.
And when you completed the MBA, did anything change in relation to your approach strategically or tactically or even from a leadership perspective? Did you notice a shift in you at all?
Yeah, I think certainly, I mean, doing the MBA, I learned a lot about models and case studies and structuring your approach to actually writing a business plan and how to structure it and how to put it together.
Yeah.
So I think that was really the key. But I think, again, as I say, I honestly benefited so much from my other colleagues on the course. And we stayed in touch. And you know, just the learning
that's
from them
the
has been fantastic.
That's half the battle itself, isn't it?
It is.
Busy people, busy lives.
Exactly.
What's the aspiration for this business now? As we're sat here, and I know we're actually sat, and there are other planes around us as well. So what's the aspiration for you leading this business? Where are you going? What's the direction of travel? No pun intended.
Yeah, I know.
There we go.
So yeah, I guess there are two strands to that. So I think in terms of the direction of the business, my philosophy is that I think we've done a pretty good job at establishing what we have.
Yes.
So I think getting that right, we're pretty much there. And I think having that as a sort of a foundation or a base enables us to be more entrepreneurial and find the next opportunity to relaunch ourselves. So to keep what we're doing stable and as is, but then to find something else and find the next opportunity that will really enable us to scale the business.
Okay.
So that's on the business side of things. I think also culturally, we're now at the stage where, having started the business, you know, a group of similarly like-minded people with a similar view on company culture, you know, we all came together and it worked beautifully.
Yes.
But now as the business has grown and as we've got more people, I think that the real challenge is to do what we've always done more intentionally. And define the standards of how we do it and get everyone thinking about how to do that much more intentionally in a much more focused way.
Right.
And I have to say, you know, again, it goes back to doing business ethically. And not a lot about that is taught at business school.
Yep.
And it's something that I find very interesting and I've read a lot about. And it's how do you implement that and how do you actually do that in your company?
Right. I was with 11 CEOs last week. We chatted about this very briefly, and there was a question that they wanted to ask each other about what drives them. What are they passionate about? Why do they get up each morning and go to work? Why do you?
The key is to have a purpose. Okay. That's the key, and I think that's also the key. What I'm doing right now as well in the business is defining what is that purpose? You know, what are we about? And that's really the key. And I think for me, I've always been so passionate about aviation. It's given me so much, and I'd now like to be able to give back. I'd like to share what I benefited from aviation in my business world to the rest of the world and actually be able to almost evangelize the world as to the real benefits of private aviation and business aviation.
Yeah.
And I think Warren Buffett discovered that back in the 80s. You know, he used to say that an aeroplane was indefensible, and then he called it the indispensable because he realized just how much benefit for a business in terms of productivity there is. And of course it's fun. Of course aviation is fun. There's no denying that. People use it for their pleasure as well.
But we're on the ground. So I want to ask about the aviation industry on two levels. One, the pandemic, because that was desperately difficult for many businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously the aviation industry was hit hard.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I want to talk to you about the perception of the private aviation industry.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's probably easy for people to target it without really understanding it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's deal with the pandemic first. How was the pandemic for you as an aviation business?
Mixed. Initially, very, very difficult. Very difficult. The phone didn't ring for months. You know, we had two aircraft in stock.
Right.
So it was a very, very trying time for, as I say, I think probably from when the pandemic started, right the way through to September of 2020. Yeah. And then the world changed. I mean, it completely went the other way.
Right.
McKinsey did a study pre-pandemic, and they said that 90% of people who can afford to fly privately chose not to. So I think the pandemic pushed a lot of those people into business aviation because they didn't have another option in commercial aviation. So they tried business aviation and they loved the experience, and I think that's what drove more and more people to business aviation, and they stayed and they remained.
It was a mindset shift, wasn't it, which I want to come back to.
Yeah.
I want to ask you on a personal level, how did you deal with, many people talk about the pandemic as a black swan, was it? That's a different question. But how did you personally deal with that downturn and that level of uncertainty where you're talking about a global occurrence of which you have no control whatsoever? So how personally did you deal with that level of uncertainty where you're saying you're sat on, you know, a couple of planes and no one's ringing and nothing's happening?
How did I personally deal with it? It's incredibly difficult. I think what really helped me, to be honest, is the fact that we still had a maintenance business. The aircraft still had to fly. I mean, even though airplanes weren't flying, obviously, for a long period during the pandemic, a lot of the maintenance inputs were routine.
Right.
And they had to be done, and we were considered an essential service. So we were allowed to continue the maintenance business and continue operating. So I think that was hugely beneficial. So, you know, the operation continued, even though sales stalled.
Yes.
The operation continued. People carried on going to work, and people still felt they had that sense of purpose that we, you know, keep coming back to. And that's what kept us going. And you just got to hang in there. I mean, it is very, very tough. And, and you know, I can give you one little story, if I may.
Please.
I know this is the
time.
But, we
love a story.
We had two airplanes in stock. And of course, it is very, very tempting. You know, the first customer that comes through the door, you say, well, you know,
this is the idea.
We purchased them. Absolutely. We did purchase them. So they were in stock.
So they're
sitting in our hangar. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So, you know, that's our risk. And of course, you know, the temptation is to sell it to the first customer that walks through the door.
Yeah.
But we don't do that. Right. And that's tough, you know, to say no, you know, to still go through the same questions and ask the customer, why are you using this aeroplane? What's your purpose? What do you want to achieve? Is this really the right aeroplane for you?
Right.
And then to have the courage to say, no, actually, we don't think this is the right aeroplane for you.
Okay.
And that's long-term thinking. That isn't just selling the aeroplane at all costs and thinking short-term about value creation or, you know, about generating a return in the short term. That's thinking long-term. Hopefully that customer had a good experience and they're going to come back in a few years' time and say, you know what, I really trust those guys because they're honest with me. We turn people down. And it's all about long-term value creation to ensure that we're getting the right customers, because what we don't want to do is have a customer who's not satisfied when they bought the aeroplane and they come back to us and say, you know what, I'd never trust those guys because they'd sell snow to Eskimos.
So what might be an obvious reason to turn someone down, even if they have the means?
Yeah, if the mission isn't right. So that's the key thing. You know, the key thing you always ask a customer is, you know, what is your mission? Why are you purchasing an aircraft? What are you intending to do with it?
Yeah.
And every aeroplane does have a specific mission. So you have to make sure that the mission suits that particular customer.
Can you give me an example? Not about an individual, but kind of an example of a mission that you hear a lot that is consistent with the purpose that you have in the business that you run.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, somebody, let's say, he wants to fly, I don't know, from London to Geneva, let's say, and they say, well, you know, the jet's faster. Sure, okay, so you're used to flying from Heathrow to Geneva Airport, I get that, but where's your office?
Right.
And what's your final destination?
Right.
And actually, have you considered flying from Redhill or Biggin Hill or Elstree? You know, you mentioned Elstree.
Yeah.
And have you considered where are you going in Geneva? Maybe Lausanne is closer, maybe Annemasse is closer.
Right.
So for that sort of mission, absolutely.
Right,
because, you know, again, the customer isn't necessarily used to business aviation and the benefits of business aviation.
Okay.
So that way we can say, okay, so yes, the aeroplane might be a little bit slower than a jet when it's airborne, but we can land you much closer to your final destination.
Right.
You know, or let's say they really do want to travel a longer distance and go to the south of Spain, for example, then we say, yes, actually the jet is better than the turboprop because that's where the speed comes into it. So every aeroplane has a different mission.
We are sat on a jet, aren't we?
We are, correct. This is a jet, yes. Although you wouldn't be able to tell, to be honest, from the cabin. I mean, they're, you know, the jet cabin and the turboprop cabin are very similar.
Right, but this is the jet version.
This is the jet, that's correct.
I feel I'm becoming more knowledgeable about certain things. I want to come back to a statistic you mentioned, that 90% of people pre-pandemic who could afford such a thing chose not to.
Correct.
That shifted.
Yes.
So that's a mindset, because I always say that it's as people believe, what they believe is then how they behave.
Mm-hmm.
So what shifted in the mindset of your customers that then they started to say, no, I've changed my mind, I will?
I think it was just simply, you know, needs must. I mean, the inability to fly commercially at the time during the pandemic drove more customers to business aviation.
Right.
And then during that process, they learned and discovered all the benefits that business aviation has to offer.
Okay.
So in the US, for example, I mean, this is a great contrast. If you contrast the US with Europe, the vast majority of customers that fly in business aviation aircraft are middle management. A lot of people don't realize that.
Oh.
They always assume it's top CEOs and top executives, but no, companies will actually buy, in the US, corporates, companies will buy a jet to fly their middle management around.
Right.
Because the US is very hub and spoke on the airlines. Yes. You know, there are long distances to drive by car, so that the network and the infrastructure in the US isn't ideally set up for public transport, and they really benefit from business aviation.
Right.
And the same is true in Europe. I mean, there are a lot of missions in Eastern Europe, or even within Western Europe. I gave you an example just now, the customer going from London to Geneva.
Yes.
That's typical Western Europe. Well, that's where you were yesterday. Yeah. So there are many, many destinations that are not accessible by airline, that are accessible by business aviation. And it's a productivity tool. You know, a few years ago, I picked up a customer in Farnborough. Actually, there are nine people on the airplane. Picked them up from Farnborough, flew them to Maastricht. One got off for a meeting.
Yes.
Then we went to, they had a meeting there, waited for an hour. Then we went to Antwerp, had another meeting there, and we got them all home at night. That would have been impossible by airline.
Right, so this is the productivity piece.
Correct.
Let me deal with some of the myth-busting or people's perception versus reality.
Mm-hmm.
Because there will be many who think, in a world that is now focused on sustainability and clean energy and carbon footprints, where does this business model, where does this level of productivity sit in that debate?
So in terms of emissions, I mean, emissions are absolutely minuscule. So aviation is 2% of global emissions. Aviation,
yes.
Business aviation, which is this sector, is I think 2% of that.
Right.
So overall, I believe the percentage is something like 0.00 something.
There's the
percent.
First myth, isn't it? Because I'm assuming myth. This private jets are very easy to point to and say,
yes,
they're the scourge of what we're trying to achieve.
Yeah. But I have to say, I mean, that does not mean that this industry is not fighting tooth and nail to become more sustainable.
Okay.
That is absolutely top priority for this industry, and we're very, very focused on that. And I think that's the huge, you talked about where this business is going in the future. That's the entrepreneurial opportunity for us.
Right.
And that's what I love about entrepreneurship. You know, this is a great time for aviation. It's to try to find a way of flying more sustainably, and the whole industry is working so hard on that.
I know you're working with the Swiss and the Italian manufacturers.
Correct.
Are you working with them as well in relation to that aspect? Do you get the feedback to them as a customer yourself?
Not yet.
You want?
Not yet, but maybe in the future. So I do have an investment in electric aviation startup as well in the UK.
I was going to ask about electric.
Yeah, so a company called Skyfly.
Right.
And so that's very much my intention is to learn from that business and to understand better what the infrastructure needs are for that sort of company. I think for us to be an OEM, a manufacturer, I think is unrealistic for our business.
Right.
But we are a service provider,
yes.
And that's what we do. So I think if we can find, what is it that every one of these aircraft is going to need, and how can we do that, then we can provide input to the OEMs, to the manufacturers,
yes.
as to how they can develop, and also we can develop something ourselves to be able to support the industry in the future.
Might there be a time in our lifetimes that we see electric flight?
Well, it's already here now. So electric aviation already
exists.
At
this level.
And not at this level. So I think it's a two or three billion industry already.
Right.
So it's very, very small trainers.
Right.
They've got no range. So I believe, some of the projections from one of the big five consulting companies, they had a prediction that in 2035, there'd be that hockey stick effect where the industry suddenly balloons.
Right.
And I believe that's probably realistic. Okay. So Technam were developing they're working with Rolls-Royce to basically produce an electric-powered version of one of their existing aircraft.
Right.
And they've now delayed that, precisely because the battery technology isn't yet there,
right.
To produce the range.
Okay.
So I think that'll take a little bit more time, but hydrogen technology is very, very interesting. I need to learn a lot more about that. But, hydrogen-powered, I think, will get us to the range more quickly for electric aircraft.
Is this also a subject that comes up with your customers who you're selling to as well?
Some of them, yes. It's important.
Especially
so
corporates.
Yes.
I'm thinking if they've got ESG policies.
Absolutely.
They're also thinking that they are potentially easy to criticise.
Correct.
Are they coming and asking those questions before they also purchase?
They do. They do. So we only, for example, we carbon offset all our flights. So we have a charter business.
Right.
So we don't even ask the customer. We just do it. So
right.
That's something that we just do. We carbon offset all our flights. We try and use sustainable fuel where we can. So Biggin Hill, for example, here, here at our base, they have sustainable aviation fuel. So it's still aviation fuel. It's still Jet A1.
Yes.
But it's produced much more sustainably, different ingredients. And that's something that's already here and now that we can actually work and grow. And Pilatus have done the same. So they've actually worked. They came here in this very aeroplane. Not this very aeroplane, but similar type.
Yeah.
And they had one engine with one fuel tank running on sustainable fuel and the other one running on normal fuel. and they analyse the results, and there's absolutely no difference at all. So the aeroplanes can run on sustainable fuel.
That's why I love this podcast. I learn all the time, which is great. let me stick to the customers, because, again, there's, as you say, Hollywood, influencers, mm-hmm. whatever it might be, there mm-hmm. is a perception about private jets.
Mm-hmm.
Let me talk to you about customer centricity, customer satisfaction. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming you talked about the corporates, but also the clients that you're looking at are the ultra high net worth,
mm-hmm.
who see this as a productivity tool.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your approach? Because I know you, integrity is massive to you, and mm-hmm. ethics is massive to you. So what is your approach as the CEO of this business in relation to the service and the product that you provide to people who are incredibly discerning?
Yeah. That's a good question. Where do I start with that?
I don't know. It was a long question, wasn't it?
It is. I think, you know, maybe you know, let's start with my belief in the purpose of business. You know, I believe that the purpose of business is not to create a profit, but to basically create a community of persons that creates value, yes. real value, real good in society. And the ultimate goal of business is to provide a very high level of service and produce real service. So I guess what I'm saying with that is it goes back to the people-centric nature of the business.
Okay.
It's a community of persons, so it's about the human being, about flourishing and developing the human being who's working in the company to produce a real service that's a real value to the customer as well. So again, it's all about the person. It puts the person at the center. So that's sort of the background. So to answer your question, I believe that really, you know, and this is what we need to learn to do every single day, and
yep.
I wouldn't say for 1 minute that we've got this cracked yet, but to be very present with a customer, to pick up little nuances that the customer says.
Right.
You might pick something up that they like, or that they, you know, that they're passionate about, and then to deliver on that and surprise them. So for example, we happened to pick up from conversing with him what his favorite champagne was. And then we discovered that he actually, unfortunately, had a horse riding accident and he broke a bone. So we could actually send him exactly the right champagne to cheer him up.
Okay.
When he actually broke his bone, you know, when he broke a leg or whatever it was, I can't remember exactly what it was now. But it's that kind of thing. So being very, very present to the customer's needs. Another customer who wanted not a productivity tool, but he'd sold his business. He'd had a liquidity event.
Yeah.
And he wanted to buy the aeroplane, frankly, as a reward to himself for all his hard work.
Right.
And he wanted to enjoy the aeroplane. And he wanted to enjoy going to all these different things. And again, by being attentive to that customer, we learnt where he goes, where he likes travelling to, where his favourite places are.
Right.
And then when he bought the aeroplane, we presented him a binder and a book of all the airports that he could fly into and all the places he could visit
right.
that suits what he enjoys doing. So it's I think service is an ingredient, and service is important, but we have to go one step beyond. We have to be okay. attentive to the person. It's all about the person and the individual.
I remember seeing something from an article as I was doing some research, Edwin. I think you talked about unreasonable hospitality.
Yes.
Is that what we're talking about?
That is exactly what we're talking about.
Tell me a little bit more about where does that come from in you then?
So that was, it was actually a book I read recently by Will Gadira, which I strongly recommend, and that's what it's called. It's called Unreasonable Hospitality. And I mean, honestly, it is a terrific book. I don't want to spoil it for the viewers, but he was in the restaurant business, so similar to us, very, very high service business, where, you know, customers would come and would spend $1,000 on a meal easily.
Okay.
And he tried to get to, you know, to the he was in the top 50 best restaurants in the world, and he wanted to get to number one.
Yes.
And he went to all these different restaurants, and he very quickly realized that actually he wasn't in the food business. His business was not about food.
Yeah.
It was about connecting people.
Right.
People come to a restaurant because they want that connection, and they want to create memories for themselves. And when he realized that, that changed everything. Then he realized that, you know, again, that unreasonable hospitality, being present. And his favorite story is, you know, he actually buys a hot dog at a New York hot dog stand. You can imagine that, you know, people are spending $1,000 on a meal.
Yeah.
And he had to convince his chef, okay, we're going to serve this hot dog.
Yeah.
And the chef looked at him and he was mad. He said, no, really, trust me on this.
But it's about the connection piece.
It's about, and they were blown away. It cost nothing. And it was an experience they would never, ever forget. And they were completely blown away by it. And it's. He always says he doesn't want to be the best restaurant. He wants to be the favorite restaurant. Because being someone's favorite restaurant is personal to them. And you can't take that away. You can always argue, okay, what does best mean?
So
well, I do this and I do that.
Number one on the list, it's actually being...
Well, no, but...
Number one to the person, to
it's
the individual.
Being correct, because I think being the best, you can always argue with it. You can say, well, you're not the best at this, you're not the best at that.
Right.
But you can never argue. Somebody says, well, you're my favorite.
Yeah.
You can't take that away from anyone. And that's the key, is, you know, how do you provide... How do you do that?
Yeah.
That's the challenge.
You remind me of a conversation I had with Gary Ridge, who was the former CEO and chairman of WD-40, which is oil in a can. And he said, I'll stop you there. He said, actually, we make memories. Just happens to be by oil in the can.
Right.
And I thought, that's genius. And of course you do.
Yeah.
So tell me, what is the emotion with a purchase such as this? Because this, in many ways, is aspirational, is something where you people can live out. As you say, someone had a liquidity event and this was a celebration in order to do things. But you're creating memories for people, aren't you?
Or we're creating memories. I think it's something to do with achieving the pinnacle of personal achievement or personal aspiration, you know, not even personal, but corporate as well.
Yeah.
You know, if you're at the stage where business aviation can become a real productivity tool, you know, that can move the business to the very pinnacle of its performance.
Yeah.
And also the individual, as you rightly said, if they've actually achieved something and they've had a liquidity event and they've worked incredibly hard all their life,
yeah,
and they can justify purchasing an airplane, it's the same kind of thing. And ditto for us internally. I mean, aviation is very highly regulated.
Yes.
Achieving a very high standard of excellence and always being at the very pinnacle of your performance as a business, all of us in the company, is all part of that as well.
Right.
So I think that encompasses both the customer, also the ethos of our company, how we should do things, and it's all of that really.
You've just spirited me on to asking a question now, because we were talking to, as I say, a number of CEOs last week who are all working in financial services and insurance, heavily regulated, pharmaceutical, legal, aviation.
Right.
So how do you as the CEO operate what I would describe, where's your freedom in the frame? Because there is strict regulation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a plane like this is looking after the lives of people. So mm-hmm. Some might consider it also high stakes.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you operate? How do you find the space to innovate and create and do things differently and maybe be a disruptor within a heavily regulated environment?
Yes, you can. And I think that this goes back to some of the examples I gave before.
Right.
You know, if you're very attentive to the customer's need, I mean, there's nothing in the regulation about giving them a binder of all the favorite places to visit. So I think that's where we can really do something that's very, very personal, the personal touch.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think, again, I mean, it is a very relevant question, because this is the challenge we sometimes have with customers.
Right.
You know, they do want to do obviously they want to do everything they possibly can with the aircraft. And sometimes we have to say, look, I'm sorry, but no, you know, we safety is a priority.
Right.
And we don't just want to stick to the rules, frankly. You know, we most important thing for us is that the customers are safe.
Yeah.
And frankly, that sometimes means going above and beyond the rules. So
right.
Yes, the rules is a bare minimum, you know, but the most important thing for us is safety. You know, again, it goes back to the human person.
Yes.
You know, their families are flying in this airplane.
Yeah,
we want to make sure their families are absolutely safe.
Mm.
And so that's sometimes a tough conversation to have with the customers, is, look, I'm really sorry, but we don't recommend this. And they get frustrated, but I think ultimately, again, long term, they understand that, you know what, I trust these guys. They wouldn't be telling us to do this if, you know, and it's a difficult conversation to have, and they know that. So
how important is it for you to be a trusted advisor or trusted business partner to your clients above and beyond the competition? Obviously, I don't know who your competition are.
Sure.
But, you know, what is your thought about you being that trusted business partner?
It's absolutely key. I mean, honestly, this aviation is business aviation especially, is all about people. It's a people business.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm doing this podcast. You know, I need to be present. I think, you know, our customers need to see the whites of the eyes of the owner of the business.
Right.
And that personal connection, being able to look in the whites of the eyes and understand, really have trust in that person, that individual.
Yes.
That they mean what they say and they're going to do it is absolutely key. If you don't have that, I think it's very difficult to do business.
So how would you describe the purpose of this business now? Because this is really, you're the CEO, you're the founder,
mm-hmm.
you're the owner. Therefore, you have a shadow.
Mm-hmm.
Within this business, not only the people that are working for you, but beyond.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you describe the current purpose of the organization?
I think it's I want the people within the organization, so we talked a lot about the customers, but I want the people within the organization to really flourish and to grow, to develop body, mind and spirit.
Right.
That's the purpose. You know, they're not coming to work to do a job. They're coming to work to, you know, to create some real value in society, to work is to create, and to create is to be human.
Okay.
And I think that for me sort of encapsulates what I'm trying to, you know, it's not just coming to work and earning money. It's actually, I think human beings are most satisfied when they're creating. And it goes back to what you were saying before. How can you be creative in a highly regulated environment? Well, that's the challenge, is if we can encourage our staff to be creative, to come up with ideas, how we can surprise our customers. It's fun.
Yeah.
It's really good fun. And they can actually enjoy doing that. And it's it's a fun thing that, you know, gets people energized, gets people enthusiastic, and that's what it's all about. And they're developing themselves, they're trying to pursue their own excellence and their own high standards. And
it's important for everyone to be able to earn a living, and it's important for every business to be sustainable.
Yes.
But it's also important for every business to have a purpose. And one of the questions I'm being asked now by some of the very largest businesses is, how do they be a force for good? Mm-hmm. How do they now provide real good for the communities within which they operate, above maybe a product or a service? Mm-hmm. How do you balance that need that people need to be able to earn a living? This needs to be a sustainable business. Mm-hmm. This needs to be a very purpose-driven business as well.
Yeah.
How do you manage that? Sometimes some people think there's a tension between the two. I don't think there is.
I don't think there is either. I really don't. I think, again, everything I've read and studied about doing business ethically is just common business sense. It just makes sense. And I think, again, it goes back to long-term value creation. I think that's where a lot of companies go wrong. You know, if you're focused on the next deal, on closing the next deal, on the next 6 months, on the next 12 months, and you forget the long term, you can actually damage the business in the long term. Right. And aviation is a long term business. You know, customers buy airplanes and keep them for a few years, and you want them to stay loyal. You want them to trust you. Yeah. So you're trying to create long term value in the business.
You're driving that, but where's that coming from inside you? I mean, that's the essence of you.
Mm-hmm.
Where's that coming from?
I think, again, it's the family business originally, so that's what I was brought up with. Dare I say, I'd have probably took it for granted.
Yeah,
I was very familiar with it. I was used to it. Then when I left the family business and started on my own, I very quickly realized that not everyone works that way, and I've seen lots of failures on the way.
Right.
I mean, you know, an obvious one everyone knows about, for example, is WorldCom. And actually, Cynthia Cooper wrote a very good book.
Right.
And she was actually the accountant that uncovered the issue with WorldCom. And again, there's a lot of integrity. So there's prudence. You know, she exercised prudence to actually uncover the problems. She exercised justice to make sure that the investors' interests were protected.
Yep.
Moderation to not go public until she had actually, you know, done all her research until it reached fruition.
Yeah.
And courage to then go public despite personal sanctions. So it's all of those things.
Okay.
And I think it's there's so many examples of companies that don't do that or that have fallen by the wayside. So that's where I realized, actually, I need to be much more intentional about how I develop this in my own business. And
right.
My management team loved it. And that was another catalyst for me.
Okay.
They said, yeah, we've experienced the opposite as well. And we realize this doesn't always happen. And that's why we fully support it. We fully endorse it. We're fully behind it. And let's embark on this journey together.
So let me ask you a couple of questions about you as a CEO. Mm-hmm. What do you think is your role now as CEO of a business?
So my role as the CEO is very much to define the culture. And also to seek out new opportunities. It's to find where the opportunities for growth are, where the business is moving in the future. To navigate. You mentioned the pandemic.
Yes.
You know, to be aware of what's happening politically, economically, to navigate the business through those choppy waters in the most effective way, and to have a vision for the future of the business. And along the way to define the culture and take the business with it, with that culture.
And are you involved in most aspects of the business, or are you hands off with many aspects of the business now?
So the management team are their own entrepreneurs.
Right.
And I really want it that way. You know, their role.
Was that deliberate?
That's absolutely deliberate.
Right. Okay.
You know, and I believe that also they should be doing the same with their employees as well. You know, that there's nothing better for the human being to feel that sense of autonomy. You know, that they're trusted.
Yeah.
You know, we trust you that you can make your own decisions, you can do things.
Yeah.
And frankly, they know a lot more about the business than I do. They really do. I mean, the maintenance guy, I mean, I wouldn't have a clue. And, you know, our flight operations and sales, I mean, they're so much better at it than I am. You know, my role is very different. So they do that. But my role is absolutely to define the culture, to make sure that we're all integrated and we're, you know, cohesive as a company, that we're one business and that we're all pulling together in the same direction.
Okay. So here's an interesting question for you. Who actually is Edwin? I know the background. You've come from six generations of entrepreneurs and business success, CEO of this business.
Mm-hmm.
But who is Edwin?
Oh my goodness, that's a tough question. I mean, I think I'm learning every single day. I mean, the day you stop learning is the day you need to say, you know, that's it. I'm not doing anymore.
Yeah.
So every single day, I think I need to learn. I need to develop myself. That's a tough question, actually. You're asking a tough question there. I don't know how to answer that.
The reason I ask you that is because you know I'm passionate about human-centered leadership, we've had a couple of conversations, and you are very people-focused and human-focused.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm intrigued in, because everyone will see Edwin, and if I look on the way, you know, the role that you have, the human doing, I'm really intrigued as the human being. Who is Edwin, if you were almost describing yourself, but not in any ways describing the background or even the role that you have now? I don't know.
Anticipate
that question.
No, I didn't anticipate that question at all. But if and I say this with honestly the greatest humility, because I'm a long way away from this. I'm really a long way away from this. But if I can help to define the industry, to shape the industry, to become more ethical, that's a side of business that's not talked about and that's not done intentionally. And if I can help to shape that and define it and to be, you know, to provide some leadership in that, you know, so that the rest of the industry will benefit and will follow on. And if I can prove that actually doing business ethically is doing business profitably. You know, we all have
it's
red
not
blood
one
cells.
Without the other.
No, I mean, we all have red blood cells, right? And, you know, without red blood cells, we die.
Right.
But do we spend every minute of the day obsessing about how many red blood cells we have? Of course we don't.
Yeah.
And it's the same with business. You know, if you're not profitable, it's not going to succeed. So, but to focus on what's really important, you know, if you focus on doing business ethically, on the service, on creating real value, on developing your staff, that's the route to profitability.
Yeah.
And if I can prove that, then I think I'll be very, very, very satisfied.
Let's talk about legacy. What is it you hope people say about you when you've stopped doing what you're doing?
What's going to be on my tombstone?
No, I don't want to talk about that. But I'm talking about
Sure.
I'm talking about when you may transition. You're not doing this role. Oh, do you know what? I'll make it even easier. Where you're with your people, you're with your team, and then you're out the room. What is it you hope they say about you?
I hope they say that I lead by example.
Yes.
That what I preach, I do. And I would like to think they've learned something from me, quite honestly. And I say that with great humility, because I have a lot to learn myself.
Yeah.
But I'd like to think that I've left a legacy in the industry that we can do things differently and do things better.
Yeah.
And continue to do things better.
Let me finish off with this question. What's the best piece of leadership advice you've given or received?
Gosh. I probably could have come up with an answer if I thought of that before.
Or even just the thing that is front of mind for you.
Mm.
Because it may well be something that's important to you right now in the context of the work that you're doing. Is there anything that kind of is front of mind for you that's important for you?
I think it's what I've said before. I really do think so, and I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself, but I think it's putting the human being. It's putting the human being at the center of everything.
Right.
The dignity and the value of the human person at the center of everything. I think that's the key. That's the key to leadership. If you put the human being at the center of everything, then I think you're well on the way to being a successful leader.
Well, I hope you've had fun.
I've had a lot of fun.
On the leadership,
it's been
enigma.
Absolutely superb,
and
you've challenged me as well. It's been thoroughly enjoyable.
I said to you,
it's great.
You'll in many ways lead the conversation, and I'm insatiably curious, and I've always said, and I continue to say, every single episode is incredibly humbling.
Mm-hmm.
It's an absolute privilege. I get to do things that I've never done before, and this is one of them. But when was the last time you had a conversation like this?
I've never.
Well, then that's
never,
great
frankly.
Feedback.
So,
there's only a number of podcasts.
Yes, yeah, so, exactly. Yeah.
You know, we are trying to get better. I'm using the wrong we.
Yeah.
Learning all the time. When you talk about learning, we're learning all the time. Just in relation to, you know, trying to set things up as we were doing on the plane, which was great fun. But what would your advice be to me with this platform and over 200 episodes now? And you know I have a passion and a focus for human-centered leadership. What would your advice be for me, maybe?
This is very practical advice, but I personally would really benefit from the experience of some of the other people on your podcast, some of the other CEOs. If they've done this, if they've implemented it, how have they done it? How have they actually achieved it? You know, what's been their success?
Yes.
And if you can draw that out of them, and that would be fascinating. I think that we could all learn from that. And
there's a real alumni now to the Leadership Enigma, I would say, with over 200 episodes. And so in some ways, that is a challenge for us now, is how do we leverage that collective?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's the board no one can afford.
Right.
And so I think that's a really good question and a really good challenge for me to say, how do we leverage the collective and how do we start in some ways to package up that learning. Mm-hmm. I've got some ideas on that, but that's another episode altogether.
Fantastic. Edwin,
you're an absolute superstar. Thank you so much
for taking
time
out of your
day.
Likewise, thank you so much, Adam. Really
appreciate
it.
Thank you so much for introducing me to this. I don't want to leave, actually, but that's just... There we go.
It's been real fun. Thank you so much. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Adam. Thanks a lot.